Welcome to the Teach Better podcast. I'm Doug McKee.
And I'm Edward O'Neill.
And we are here to talk about teaching and learning.
On today's episode, we talk to John McKenzie about helping students and instructors alike write using smart media, getting beyond the comfort zone of Microsoft Word and PowerPoint.
In today's episode, we're joined by the difficult to categorize John McKenzie. He is currently a visiting professor in Cornell's English department, and he is a Dean's Fellow for Media and Design. He's a teacher, he's an artist, and he's a teacher of artists. And his work crosses many, many disciplines, and he's actually been accused of being post-disciplinary. Welcome, John. We have so many questions for you.
I'm glad to be here.
So, John, you spend a lot of time thinking about new kinds of media, and you've coined this term smart media. Maybe you could start just telling me what exactly is smart media, and how does it differ from new media or multimedia? Educate us.
So yeah, I came up with the term smart media as a way to define emerging scholarly genres such as TED Talks and podcasts and even scientific posters, multimedia presentations, things that scholars were starting to do in addition to traditional books and articles. It differs from multimedia. That's a larger category. You can have lots of different, if you like, content in multimedia and digital media. It's not restricted, obviously, to digital media, but digital media is the primary form that I work in and that I try to get students and other instructors to use. So, that's what it means. I invented it in the context of this thing called Design Lab, which was like a writing center at UW-Madison, and we were trying to figure out what to call the thing, the genres we were focusing on, and smart media seemed like the best term.
And so the idea is that it's not just the type of medium, but also the fact that you're communicating things that would normally communicated. It's what scholars use to communicate knowledge to students and to other scholars.
Yes, that was a good way to begin to define it. So it can be highly conceptual. Potentially any content can be put into smart media. So it's different from, say, fictional film, and it's often, I would distinguish it even from art. Although art can be a smart media, highly conceptual art can be smart media. But generally, artists don't think of themselves as necessarily just communicating ideas. There's other things going on in art.
What do you think of the word critical? Because that's one I wrestle with, and you know, when professors want to have their students use media, you know, the word critical is so big in the humanities, and oftentimes it ends up being a question of, well, I want them to make something visual, but I want it to be critical, say not pretty or not design, but critical.
Oh yeah, well, critical is a very, very important term. I'm actually working on with a collaborator on a book about the pedagogy that I've used to create smart media. It's called Studio Lab, and the book is tentatively titled Studio Lab Manifesto, Critical Design for Liberal Arts. And so critical design, I don't know if you're familiar with that term and phenomenon, is bringing, it's sort of like analogous to smart media, bringing critical thinking into other media than writing, because its dominant form has been the phonetic alphabet taught in seminars. And so critical thinking and trying to bring that into other media is what I call critical design, and other designers are trying to do that as well. So yeah, critique is an important part, but I would say also creativity is an important part, because what I try to teach students is that even critical concepts and critical systems, you know, Marxism, feminism, critical race, all of those were invented and the concepts were invented. So we need to think about what is the invention or the creative moment in creating concepts, and smart media is a new way to invent critical concepts and critical practices.
This goes to something that we struggle with in higher ed when we talk about teaching, is that sometimes, we've discussed this on the show, that the word skills is kind of a dirty word, and so there's kind of skills and ideas or concepts, and you know, a lot of professors, I think, rightly think, well, I'm teaching ideas and concepts, I'm not teaching skills. But so how do you kind of push for thinking of them together?
Well, I have a number of design frames I've developed over the years, and one of them, this gets to the question about evaluation, one of them is CAT, conceptual, aesthetic, and technical. And so this comes out of, you know, I trained as a painter originally and studied all different kinds of artistic practices. And so critiques, crits, studio crits is an important part of my pedagogy and thinking about smart media. So we talk about the conceptual components of a work. We talk about the technical components of the work, and that maybe that's the skill level. And then there's the aesthetic. And that's really kind of, you know, how do these conceptual components take shape in a particular media, whether it be, you know, a podcast or a video or a multimedia presentation. So using that CAT, conceptual, aesthetic, and technical frame, you can think about analyzing work, and then you can flip it around and use it to make work.
Nice.
So John, why would we want to do this? What's wrong with just words?
Well, to begin with, there's no such thing as just words. So I trained, I was steeped in post-structuralist thoughts, and in particular Derrida's reading of Plato and Plato's Pharmacy. So words have a very particular relationship to concepts and also to phonetic writing. And I'm really interested in getting past logocentricism, or word-centered thought, which we call knowledge, and away from just simply writing. And it's so writing and words always have some kind of support or infrastructure that's there. And so for me, thinking about logocentricism, which Derrida defined as the greatest ethnocentricism the world has ever known, is trying to open up different types of thought in different media. And so I'm not against words by any means, in fact, in my assignments, words and phonetic writing play an important part, but we try to reinscribe that within a different media space, if you like, much as the film theorist and director Artaud thought about reinscribing words within a theatrical space. I'm trying to reinscribe logos within a different space within the institution.
So, Edward, this episode is already giving me a lot of empathy for how you must feel when we do our science episodes.
No,
because I'm understanding probably every other word out of John's mouth.
Well, I was going to say, in the learning area, we try and stick to or use empirical research. And actually, even in research and cognition, people who look at visual processing versus verbal processing, it seems like, from some things I've seen, that different people think visually to varying degrees, and some people think almost entirely in symbols, and some people think very, very visually, and some people think very, very verbally. So it must be a challenge, in a sense, to get students to do all. I mean, students must have a clear strength at a certain point towards abstraction or verbal writing or visualization.
Well, right. We might ask why we think just about the verbal and the visual. You know, Plato distinguished eidos, ideas, ideation, from imagos, a visual kind of thinking. So we already have two kind of visual thinking right there, and they associated imagos with Homer, and two different kind of speech, logos versus mythos, that is storytelling versus logic. You know, but what Homer was doing also involved moving the body. It involved dance, it involved tactile. So there are all sorts of different kind of learnings besides just, if you like, verbal and visual, although those are very, very important. And so another way to put this is to, how do you reinscribe logic within a narrative space or a mythic space? How do you reinscribe ideation within another kind of space? So yeah, there are, I agree, there are different kind of learners. And I think they're, even just the distinction between verbal and visual, while it's an important one, there may be, you know, there are people that are tactile, people that are blind and deaf. So how do they learn? How do they move through the world?
So that makes a lot of sense. But to make it more concrete, you have this TED Talk, which we'll link to in the show notes, where you show an article that you had a student write. I think it was about the composer John Cage.
Right, and actually, I didn't have him write. It was written in another seminar, so the idea was, the assignment was for students to take papers they had written in other classes and then remediate or transmediate them into different smart media. So they were, I didn't do the original assignment.
So what I thought was brilliant about this is you didn't just have them do it once. You had them do it, had the student do it twice. So the first time through, they created a new document that was text, but it was much more, I don't know, published. Instead of just being a long sequence of words, it had chunks laid out all over the pages. There was, it was using different font sizes. It was using images. And it really told a, it seems to tell a quite a different story.
Yes, that was, so the assignment there was to, I would now say transmediate a traditional seminar paper into a graphic essay. And Steele Wagstaff took a paper that he had written on John Cage's Silence. And he we taught Photoshop and InDesign. And he created something that really looked like a zine. So there's a different reader, a different user experience, reader experience. And it, you're right, the visual track brings in a different evidence track. So, I mean, one thing that's really cool about smart media and transmediating knowledge is you can make stronger arguments, paradoxically, because instead of just citing the work of John Cage textually, you can show photos, you can show, you know, John Cage was himself someone who experimented with text, the acrostic techniques, you can, you know, cut and paste those and put them in. And then the second assignment was to then transmediate that graphic essay into a film. I actually think it was a, I think it was a really, originally what might have been a Pecha Kucha presentation, which is a 20 by 20 format, 20 slides, 20 seconds. And you do that in, you could do that in PowerPoint or Keynote. And then he, what Steele did was to create a video out of that. And a lot of the image he used came from that, that essay. And then what was really great is that he introduced another evidence track, and that was the audio track. And so he had his own voice speaking. He has lots of music, found music that is in there, and sound effects.
Not silence?
Well, no, yes, he did. He has he has a clip in the full version of it. He does. He has a clip from, I think, the London Philharmonic performing Silence. And so you hear the audience coughing and scraping. So it, what's really amazing about that particular one, it gets back to Cage's, you know, if you like, quote-unquote, original medium of sound. So, again, it's not you're getting away from arguments and evidence. You're reinscribing them within a more general space. And I would argue you can make more persuasive arguments. One big purpose of having students transmediate knowledge into different genres is to reach different audiences, not just the specialists that they are traditionally trained to write to. So how, and right now, it, that's a very important thing for higher ed to be doing, is thinking about other audiences.
Yeah, writing for different audiences, is it should be part of writing. And just to kind of corroborate what you're saying, some writing professors I worked with at USC, they had much more success with, say, student presentations when the students wrote, did the research and the drafting and the writing of a paper first, and then they could really use that as a resource. Because it can be harder for a student to use a new output medium and do the thought formation and drafting and revising and stuff. So that idea of taking a paper and, you know, remediating or transmediating it, I've seen just kind of vanilla writing professors do.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, I trained originally as an artist and was, you know, kind of immersed into the traditional model of the romantic genius, but quickly discovered that new media has, is a different type of creativity. It's not the neoclassical, you know, copy the greats. It's, and it's not the romantic, you know, you're a genius and something inside of you is producing this. It's more of a recombinant or Brie Kallur approach, and so I'm constantly reusing things from other folks. I don't claim too many moments of sheer originality, because I often usually find that it's already been invented, and Google can help keep one real humble there. So, and it's great that writing instructors across the country have long been doing, you know, photo essays and introducing other media in there. So I'm just trying to provide kind of a new, or if you like, a more systematic approach with design frames and thinking about the learning spaces in different ways.
And in film and the visual arts, juxtaposition is a well-known phenomenon where, you know, it's not one plus one, it's not this plus that, but kind of this times that. That was Eisenstein's description of montage. You know, right. You put a word next to an image. I mean, we've all seen, you know, this is not a pipe. A painting right. of a pipe and the written on it is this is not a pipe.
Right.
So we kind of, people know from other experiences that putting different kinds of media together has these really interesting effects. But we don't ask students to do it enough. And I think professors could be a lot more aware of the what happens when you do that. Even, you know, an illustration in a scientific paper is slightly different. It's a more kind of narrow focus kind of meaning that you're going for.
What was the class that you taught this?
Taught the Steele's essay?
Yes. Where you had the two exercises. What was the title of that class?
Oh.
What department was the class
that in? That was a graduate course at UW-Madison, and okay. It was probably something like, might have been something in future learning or
okay.
you know, digital media or digital humanities. I use different kind of frameworks.
And what did a day in that class, so these people show up for class, what does it look like? Is it you showing them lots of examples? Is it you walking them through like the Photoshop menus?
So the pedagogy is called Studio Lab for a reason, and it tries to mix the activities found in seminar classes, which is often highly textual and highly conceptual, studio courses, which are obviously much more of an aesthetic discourse, working with different media, and a computer lab. And so there you're learning software. And, you know, when I originally invented this at NYU in the mid-90s, I would take folks out. It was in the Department of Performance Studies. We leave a performance studio where we held seminar discussions and other things and go down to a computer lab and come back. So while I was at UW-Madison, I got the opportunity to build a media studio. And by simply putting all the tables on wheels, you could do seminar, studio, and lab activities in the same space. And so this is another one of kind of like innovations. So you might come in and start with a discussion, some reading, depending upon kind of the material that the course is addressing. For instance, one of my courses, we look at activist groups such as the Yes Men, Guerrilla Girls, Critical Art Ensemble. So we'll read and look at materials, discuss materials, and we'll talk about their aesthetic decisions, talk about their work in terms of tactical media. They have a particular thing they're trying to do with particular audiences, and so there's, if you like, a rhetoric or a style, some aesthetic decisions. And then we might then turn around and learn some software. And originally, I was teaching that software. At Madison, it was great. There was an outfit that would come and teach virtually anything. So you might start by doing critical discussion, then learn some software, and then spend the rest of the class making, you know, like bringing these concepts, and that's really where the aesthetic. So I try to teach in big three-hour blocks, so you can do all of this and get all of these juices flowing and get the skills that are normally separated. So if you think about the seminar space is really what's used by the humanities and the social sciences. Labs obviously are come out of science and engineering, and some media, of course, but you know, those were originally computer labs, were dominated by, you know, engineers and things. And then the studio space of artists and designers. So there is a transdisciplinary approach, and students, you know, may learn these activities kind of at random as undergraduates. Like they'll have to go across campus and do, but there's not a place to integrate those. And so what Studio Lab does is allow you to integrate those activities and those different parts of your brain and your body, and you rearrange the furniture. Seminar table, break it out to work tables, or put set up in rows and teach software. And that's, there is a, you know, a learning environment, a spatial environment that goes with the pedagogy.
Sometimes on this show, we say that an innovation in teaching is using another discipline's method, which you seem to do very almost kind of rigorously, I would say. And, you know, I sometimes feel that professors just lack other models for what teaching would be. So people know what the lecture is, they know what the seminar is, but the idea and a lab, and usually one discipline does one thing, like lecture, you know, discussion lab. But the workshop or the studio, where you come in and either work actively and get help or show the stuff you've made and talk about it, it's really less familiar. You could really call active learning, what people are calling active learning, kind of a lab or workshop or studio for, you know, non-art disciplines.
That's an interesting observation. I think you're right. Again, I originally trained as a painter, and you know, I did sculpture, printmaking, and learned how to work in different media. And then the crit is really an important part. And stepping back and letting students contribute to the crit, mm-hmm. is really a key part. And that's how they learn the design frames. I teach these, in addition to CAT, there's a UX design frame, user experience design frame, and I try to get them to develop a formal language, and this is how you are able to talk about different works. Potentially anything can be spoken about through those frames, and you're right. I mean, specialization causes one to focus on particular media and particular spaces, and we become experts in that, and so my work is post-disciplinary in that tries to be post-expertise. It's post-epistemic in that it's trying to be post-ideational and think beyond thought as just the formation of ideas. And that causes one to mix these spaces in different ways. There is a fourth space, and that space is the field. And this is getting outside of the university itself, out into communities, out into other institutions. And I use the design thinking frame to teach students what it is to collaborate and co-create with other folks. So those are the three primary frames I use, CAT, UX, and the design thinking frame, to teach students and potentially faculty the ways to open up their thinking and their learning.
And have you shared these approaches with people who are more ensconced in a discipline, like who are teaching science or teaching, say, literature in a fairly traditional way?
I'm at the University of Wisconsin. I would do workshops and presentations on smart media. There I was really, as director of Design Lab, I was really kind of pitching Design Lab and trying to get their students to come over. Here at Cornell, I've only been here for this past fall semester. I'm not yet teaching here.
What have you accomplished so far?
what deliverables have you created?
So I've done a number of workshops. I'm working with an initiative called Engage Cornell, which is it's a new initiative here that kind of piggybacks on the public services and the extension office here at Cornell to get knowledge out into the community. And Engage Cornell is trying to bring a research component into this. And so, yeah, I met yesterday with a professor of environmental sciences and sustainability. She is already using different media with her students. And, you know, each of these disciplines, they do have a media support. And they may be logocentric, but they do have other media that they are using. And so it's becoming more versed and more skilled. And I'm working on a book now, kind of a manifesto, to try to get this out there to other folks.
So two things. So one is, it makes perfect sense that it's a perfect match, you and Engaged Cornell, because the community is a very different audience than other people in your own discipline.
Right.
Forget about crossing disciplines. This is going outside of the disciplines to real people. And so it makes perfect sense that you'd want to use a lot of different kinds of media to communicate with those different audiences. The other thing I want to say is, it makes perfect sense that someone who, in his art and his scholarship, mixes together different ways of working would also mix together different ways of teaching. And so you have this like big collage of pedagogy in your classes, which you call Studio Lab, and that's fascinating. And it's inspiring too.
I'm glad you find it inspiring to think about it going out into other places. At Madison, I had did a thesis, worked with a senior English student who came into Design Lab and said she wanted to learn to whatever she wanted to do, she wanted to create some different media, and we got to talking about what she was interested in doing. And I paired her with a service learning class and with a professor there by the name of Nancy Budinger, and they went out into the local juvenile justice unit there. I can't remember what they call these facilities in Madison. And what they did, there was a class, and they went out and worked in some of these smart media forms, and they co-created media with these youths. And they focused on kind of a portrait, self-expression. They focused on kind of community awareness, and they focused on career skills, things that these kids could perhaps go out and use out in the working world. And it was very, very successful. That's just that's an example of how this can get outside of the university and out into the communities.
Okay, so this is actually a nice segue to something else I wanted to talk about, which is you don't always have your students working individually. You have like these interesting ways that you put students together to work, where sometimes you have them work where they have very complementary skills, and other times you have them work together when they have very similar kinds of skills. Can you talk more about that?
Yes. So, one of the things I'm trying to do is introduce collaboration to and I'm coming out of the humanities, and that's primarily, again, the lone genius, the lone writer. What does it mean to do collaborative projects? And so I'm working currently under the model of critical design teams. And within those teams, and we can think about them, they're like rock bands, they're like startups. Folks inside of them have different skills. And when I first started thinking about this, I called them bands. And so a team would be working on a project, say they were going to create an electronic performance using Brecht as the kind of a tutor director, or Artaud, or Liz LeCompte. And so they would all be focusing on that director and what the kind of theatrical things they were doing in order to create, to remediate, to mix that up and create something that involved media. But in a team like that, you don't want everyone to have the same media skill. So then I thought, okay, they need to also work in guilds. So a set of students from each band would, say, become Photoshoppers. Some would become the HTML, the webmasters, if you like. Some might work on just on sound. And by then weaving these different technical skills, so they could all go off and learn these skills together. It'd be like all the drummers, going over and practicing, or all the guitarists practicing their licks together. And then learn those skills, hone those, and then bring those back into the band and crank, if you like, those skills. And so, I'm very influenced by Critical Art Ensemble, Steve Kurtz's work on, how you form these hacktivist groups. And, sometimes there's a conceptual person, sometimes there's a media person, sometimes there is a real techie. And I worked, when I was at NYU, I worked in the web industry during the first boom and bust of the web industry. And there I was a creative. I wrote and then became an information architect. And I realized I'm a creative. Over here are the engineers. And then then there were the salespeople, the suits, that counted relationships with the clients. And so I realized that this kind of cultural dimension, this technical dimension, and this organizational dimension, those were key skills within these groups. And so within any group, you're going to have some specialization. I mean, maybe you can conceptually have an all, drummer band. That would be kind of interesting. So you get them to work with different skills. And again, the thing that coheres them is the project itself, the critical project itself that they're working on.
Collaboration is constantly being talked about as an important skill for undergraduates to leave with, which it sounds like you focus on. I think you said in passing, I think you described a tutor text. From my experience in film studies, I remember there's an essay by Daniel Dayan where he's analyzing a film clip and he's referring to it as a tutor text. The idea that the text, by your work analyzing it, it's actually teaching you something. Is that how you're thinking of tutor texts, or do you want to can you maybe unpack that phrase a little bit?
Sure. That's a term that I really got from studying with Greg Ulmer as a master's student at the University of Florida, and I was studying film theory and other media theory with him. And a tutor text is one that you precisely approached less analytically as heuristically. You're trying to learn from this text, and both in terms of maybe content, but as importantly in terms of formal and technical and techniques. You know, Godard is a great, you know, tutor text. He's doing amazing things conceptually and formally in such a way that it's hard to pull those things apart. And so you're not necessarily copying Godard or Eisenstein, but you're doing something sort of inspired or in the spirit of, and it could look totally different. And in my classes, what I do, the content of the class are tutor texts. And the way I've been teaching the last few years, I kind of cycle through different things. I could do graphic novels. I could do, say, experimental theory. That is theory that folks have, you know, done something interesting with the book. McLuhan and Fieri's The Medium of the Massage is an example of that. And then also I use the activist groups themselves as tutor text. And what's beautiful there, it's they model not only, say, the aesthetic side and the technical side, but they're also the organizational side. And again, this is getting back to critical art ensemble and the importance of thinking about that. Most people, when you think about organizations, it's bureaucracies, it's this heavy weight that's, you know, bearing down upon you. But, you know, my reading of Foucault is that, you know, power doesn't just oppress. Before it can oppress, it has to create something. And there is actually an affirmative power that can be found in organizing. And anyone that's doing any kind of political activism figures that out pretty quickly. So organizationally, collaboration is a very important part. It can be very, very difficult, obviously, but that is an important component of the pedagogy.
So different media aren't just kind of different output formats. They involve different kinds of social organization.
Right, right.
Originally, I thought that doing the evaluation, because at the end of the day, we have to assign grades to students, was going to be a real serious challenge with these new kinds of media. This is about as far from the multiple choice test as you can get. I mean, people have been creating papers for a long time, and I think there are ways to go about that and rubrics you can write. But if you're having them create a virtual reality environment, and that's what they're going to pass in, I'm not sure those rubrics translate. And so I'm real curious how you even do that, or do you just punt and give everyone an A?
If I told the students at the beginning of the class everything they were going to do, a lot of them would just drop the class because they would never. Yeah, I'm never going to. In this class, you're going to, you know, read a bunch of crazy theory text. You're going to, you know, create a video. You're going to create a website. You're going to create a multimedia presentation, and then, you know, then you're going to pitch this to people role playing as, you know, stakeholders or something. You know, they would just run out of it. So I unfold it slowly, but the design frames allow me to evaluate. And the cat in particular is very, very crucial. I mean, traditionally in writing a paper, I mean, the cat of a paper is whatever the content, the conceptual part is whatever the content is, you know. Geography, philosophy, their arguments and evidence being produced. The aesthetic is something we call clarity. You know, is there a nice introduction? Does it logically follow out? Is there a conclusion? And technically, those are produced in Microsoft Word. I mean, that's the tool that's used. And we don't even teach people Microsoft Word. We expect them to come in and have that. And we do teach the five-page essays, kind of the default one. Like, that's the aesthetic frame, the architecture of it. So CAD allows you to do this. What's really hard, I mean, you can tell when something technically is wrong. The hard part is really the aesthetic piece. And Ed, you know this, because studying film studies and studying films, there's a whole film language there to talk about film. And there's one for painting, there's one for music, there's one for, you know, everything has its own formal language. And so I have the benefit that I've studied a lot of different forms, and so I can kind of step back and look, there are all these different ones. And so trying to teach that to everyone is really, really hard. And so depending on the faculty, the faculty won't know it either. Yeah, exactly. They don't know it either. So that is one of the challenges of the pedagogy, but CAT provides you a way at least to get started. And most people can do the conceptual and the technical, because if there's something, you hear it or you see the technical problem, you know, you usually don't notice unless there is a problem or if it's overused or something. But, you know, developing the a nuanced aesthetic language, you know, I would go to like Bordwell's, you know, what is it, film? What is
art.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, learning just what is the way to describe film? What's the way to describe painting? What's the way to describe music? I'm primarily a visual guy. I'm not much of a music guy. So that's, you know, I've had to kind of learn that discourse.
But, so I want to connect what you're saying with kind of Doug's follow-up question. Mm. It sounds like a lot of frameworks to introduce, and I'm wondering how you introduce them, or scaffold their introduction, because you know, if the students are learning quite new skills, it can be, you know, when you're first learning a skill, you basically fumble. That's the kind of, you know, somebody can guide your hands, but when you do it on your own, you're completely fumbling. And then you have all this cross-media aesthetic, technical, and conceptual skills. So, you know, you created the perfect theory for yourself. How do you work with faculty who may not care about the technical part, or maybe, you know, uncomfortable with aesthetic analysis?
Well, that's an interesting question. I find, you know, I'm in the humanities, and most humanists know the aesthetic of writing, and they know the technique of writing. They know words, they know Microsoft Word. So getting them to experiment, say, with, you know, iMovie or a video. And frankly, I found that if you've got the right kind of infrastructure, learning support at a university, you can outsource the technical training. That is, you could have the Center for to come in and do some software training. It's great, and it's best if the faculty learns how to make videos, learns how to transmediate their own work, and, you know, and they do this. Conference presentations are not written papers. You go, and I mean, film studies, I expect you show clips, you talk about them. There is a different evidence track. So people are transmediating their work in different ways. And in the sciences, they create these scientific posters. So you kind of draw upon their home transmedia skills and get them to develop a language or build on that language. I should say, so how do I do this? So in addition to the CAT frame, there is the user experience frame. And I teach this, and it's got three components: experience design, that's crafting the emotional and the cognitive experience of the audience. And it's in literature, it's studies that would be like reader response. It's more of a phenomenological approach. In addition to user experience, in the UX frame is also information architecture. How is the information experience structured at a large degree? So in a museum, you know, what do you first see when you come into a museum? What's the second thing you see? And the third piece of that is information design, and that is, if you like, the shot-by-shot analysis. If you're looking at a display, you know, what's the visual track? What's the little text over here? What is it saying? You know, how is this laid out? And believe it or not, students learn this because I ask them to use the words over and over again. I'll take them out to do the UX. I'll take them into a museum. When I was at NYU, we'd go up to the Natural History Museum and we would look at the scientific displays. Here's a body of knowledge that's not presented in a book, but it's presented spatially. So what's happening here using CAT and UX? What's the user experience of a science museum? It's some kind of mixture of instruction and entertainment, you know, almost Brechtian. I don't know if there's alienation effects happening there. And it's laid out in a very particular way. It could be laid out, you know, in terms of, if you go to the Museum of the Earth here, obviously the timeline plays a huge role in how the entire museum is structured. It's chronologically, and you walk through different ages. And within that architecture, you have different information designs, different colors, different fonts. And so I have students who will spend, you know, a class, will go in and I'll say, okay, here's this museum. I'll assign each group an exhibit to look at, and they do spot analyses. They're using the work of Donald Norman. I don't know if you know Donald Norman. He was an interface HCI guy. He looks at things like visibility and feedback and conceptual models of the designer and of the user. And students can learn to do this. It's like the flipping the classroom. You ding them a lot. They learn. You know, you test them a lot, and they will respond. And so it is a lot, but students somehow do it.
It's like teaching any analytical vocabulary. You say, you show them a close up, and the difference between a close up and a long shot, and then you show them a clip, and then you ask them where was the close up, and then why was it a close up, and it. Well, if you're teaching literature, let's look for metaphors, or you know. So it's an analytical vocabulary, and in a sense, I think most people know how to teach that.
Right.
I mean,
right.
What's interesting here is, I can watch a movie and appreciate it, but I'm not going to know why I appreciate it in a lot of ways. I would love to assign my students, say they don't have to write a paper, they can create a video explaining some particular market because I teach economics. I'd love to have my students break out of the kind of the plain vanilla 8.5 by 11 sequence of words. But I don't have the expertise myself to evaluate whether they've done a good job. And even if I did, I certainly wouldn't have the expertise to tell them how they could do a better job. And so maybe we're at a point where I would like to kind of outsource not just the training of film production, but also the at least some of the evaluation of the film production. Maybe the A and the T, and I'm good with the C, the concepts, but somebody else can tell me whether it fits the aesthetics and the if they've done the technical things right.
Well, you know, in the UK, evaluation is often done by people other than the instructors.
Right.
They swap
right.
the papers around.
Right. It's wild.
So that, yeah. So, you know, there are models for that. And, I know, Doug, that you've worked on a proposal here at Cornell for active learning. And the model there is to bring in a postdoc, train them up in the method, and then pair them with a faculty and teach them that method. So, you know, would something like that work for Studio Lab? Could you learn all of those aesthetic languages? Or would, you know, film is definitely a killer language to learn because the establishing shot, the mid-range shot, the close-up, you know, students, you can see that if you were to stop back. And, you know, when you first learn film, start studying film, a lot of people say, you've ruined it for me because all the magic is gone.
Right.
Now I see what all the tricks are doing.
But then you're a connoisseur.
Yes, that's right. Are there a core set of, say, visual and certainly textual, audio languages, and you know, maybe those will emerge. These specialized discourses that, you know, they weren't always here, they were developed, and I think digital media calls upon us to develop new models, and certainly HCI, human computer interaction, introduces a whole set of interactive components. You know, when I was at the University of the Arts, those students would do a full year of writing, a full year of visual, a full year of sound, a full year of interactive, and get this, they would start off with a full year on collaboration.
Wow.
Yeah. That's robust.
Yeah. And so there are ways to spike this out. Yeah.
After film school and teaching, you know, film for many years, I was able to finally figure out that, you know, there are fiction films and documentaries and avant-garde films. And I slowly realized, oh, there's a story and there's an argument and there's a pattern, and each has this kind of form. A story is actions unfolding over time, and an argument is usually compare, contrast, or before, after. A pattern is just purely an aesthetic pattern, louder, softer, brighter, darker, etc. And so at the even macro level above things like establishing shots, these are patterns that occur across media. I mean, they can be done simply in images or in moving image clips, or, you know, paragraphs can be, you know, sentences can be done that way. That's the difference between a story, an essay, and a poem.
Right, right. That's a really great insight, and I like that. I'm taking notes here from you. It's really interesting that, you know, McLuhan said in an age of information overload, where you basically could have all these disciplines or all these different discourses, pattern recognition is what's left. And
right.
So maybe the bigger, you know, are arguments and stories themselves types of patterns, or I don't know. But I think I really like the way you spike this out, and I'm going to steal that from you.
I have a gallery at Mitchek. We can share the link. It's a Tumblr gallery, and it has some resources on this.
Oh,
and
that's great.
The perception thing, I think, is interesting, because the perceptual in Germany early in the 20th century, there were people, Gestalt psychologists, which became perceptual psychology. And there's a few things that go across the senses. One is contrast. This is, I put, you know, the water is hotter than the air, and, you know,
right,
I walk
right
out the door and it's suddenly colder. Contrast, clusters, gaps, interruptions. There's only a few big perceptual experiences and patterns, and they occur across the senses.
Oh yeah, that's very helpful. Again, I'm taking notes here, and I mean it's interesting. You started with contrast, and that you know, one thing I guess that the 20th century will be known for is the philosophies of difference. And
right.
I think noticing differences, and you think about that in terms of diversity and all these different phenomenon at different scale and in different systems. It is interesting. That very very helpful. Thanks.
Cool.
So all this is really interesting, but I want to get back to grading.
Okay.
Because we all know how much I love grading.
Everyone loves grading.
It's the best part of teaching, right? Okay, it's not the best part of teaching. It's probably the worst part of teaching.
It's hard.
But
laborious.
But if you do a good job, that your students won't come bugging you about it. And I think that's enough right there to want to do a good job with the grading.
And they improve.
In some sense, you could think of grading as just feedback.
Yeah.
And so it's feedback. You want to give it early and often. But we also want students to work in groups, especially these heterogeneous groups, where I love this vision of the band, where like everybody can kind of pretend that they're the lead singer or the bass player. But it does make grading even harder. What do you do when you've got a group or a band that's submitted their thing, and you've like done the hard work of figuring out what it is and how good it is? How do you grade that? Like, how do you assign grades to the individual as that are part of the group, or do you just go ahead and give everybody in the group the same feedback and the same grade?
That's a great question. Yeah, so grading can be a challenge, and so I've talked about the cat frame. Well, there's an extension of that, which is cat-o, and that is putting O, an organization, into the frame. And so what I have students do, students will the projects call on them to create a suite of smart media. So they often will do some sort of written proposal or analysis. They'll do a multimedia presentation. They'll create a video trailer or a demo, and they'll create a website, because these critical design firms often brand themselves, and they're role-playing, and they assign different tasks to one another. And so what I ask students to do is to, during the final presentation, is to evaluate each group's presentation. And so they use CAT to do that. And then I ask them internally to evaluate their own project and the contributions of the members, just for their own group. And so they describe the responsibility of, student A, student B, student C.
And they have clear roles.
They do have clear roles. And those are often predefined. They define them by themselves. I'm going to do the major writing, or I'm going to do the Photoshop work. And they describe, you know, they work together. You know, someone will lay down a draft and someone else will look at it. And the important thing, you know, and this is where the aesthetic part of CAT comes up, you want these different pieces of smart media to hang together. So they should have a similar aesthetic, they should have similar content, even if the tools they use, the technical, is going to be different in each one of those cases. So they assign grades, and I ask them to assign letter grades, and I tell them that that will be used in my evaluation. I don't let it determine everything. And then I use CAT in giving my feedback. Conceptually, this is what was happening. Aesthetically, this is what was happening. Technically, this was what was happening. And organizationally, this is what is happening.
So the method is the rubric.
Yeah, and they are used in some sense. I try to fold these things over, you know. And again, CAT maps into seminar space. The conceptual is the seminar. The aesthetic is the studio. And the technical is the lab space. So, I'm looking for these patterns and where I can kind of simplify things and have them fold over on top of each other. And so, again, they come out of there knowing CAT, UX, and in the classes I teach design thinking, they get enough experience with that to get themselves into trouble. One semester at UWM, I think it was, teaching a spring semester, and these were a lot of seniors, and I think four or five of them said they got jobs just knowing UX and what UX was, because it is, in some sense, the rhetoric of new media. It's what interface designers use, and it's a critical skill out there in the world. They're not UX experts by any means, but at least they know enough about it to be able to, people go, oh, experience design, that's, we're interested in. Yeah, customer service, there's service design, all sorts of things that, so they, organizationally, there is a way to evaluate that. It does, students get nervous, sometimes they don't like to put grades on one another, but I tell them, look, you're going to be out there assessing other people, and you're going to be assessed, so don't step back from this, because this is, being able to articulate and then use some kind of formal language to describe what you're doing. So it isn't just, I like this movie because, I don't know. That's all they can say.
That's very cool. Yeah. I mean, getting the students actually involved in substantive evaluation, that's really interesting.
Well, I mean, another project I've done, and this goes with the course that I've taught under the rubric of something like future learning, I'll have groups redesign a major or redesign a program, or redesign a student service on campus. And again, this goes to the design thinking component where you put the user at the very beginning, Donald Norman's, if you think about that person first, the audience, the stakeholder, whatever you want to call them, and not at the very end of the design process, and then hand them a big manual, and call them stupid if they can't figure it out. I mean, you look at Apple. Apple has no manual. How did they do that? They use user-centered design in order to make things that people just kind of intuitively know. I mean, it doesn't work quite that way. But in that project, then we had I brought in folks to role play as stakeholders, and they were real stakeholders. I had some communication students, and you had the chair and the associate chair of the communication department come in and hear how this set of students would redesign their entire major.
That's very cool. Yeah. We've taken a ton of your time.
Okay, that's all right.
We've talked about a lot of really good stuff, and it's just about time to let you go off and do more of this rather than talking to us about it.
Okay.
But we always close the show the same way, which is we ask our guests to tell us about a memorable mistake that they made in their classroom, or in your case, in your seminar or your studio or your lab, and what you learned from it.
Sure, gosh. Well, I mean, the pedagogy is experimental, so there are lots of failures and mistakes that happen along the way. And if you're not making them, you're probably not pushing the envelope enough.
There you go. That's what Doug always says.
Yeah. So it's probably around collaboration. Before I really have students kind of internally evaluating one another, it was pretty opaque what was happening inside of groups. And so this was in at the University of the Arts, I was teaching a studio class, an advanced studio class in multimedia. And I had the students in, I think, three groups, and they were role-playing as, some kind of crazy design firm. And I can't remember exactly what the content was, but there was one group that named themselves Team Kickass, and they did. They produced great, great stuff. And it was led by a really great guy named Jason Smith that went on to do some really cool project. But I had this other group that was led by, I came to find out later, an anarchist. And self-create. And, you know, every time I would kind of check in, how's it going? It would be fine, everything's fine, it's going great. And then when they come to present, it was an unmitigated disaster. And then everyone said, oh, it was terrible from the get-go. And so I was like, okay, I need to play a more active role, and if you like, as a kind of a manager. And so I often think, what is my role? Am I a producer? Am I a manager of these little design teams? And so that was a mistake. And I still, even when I know there's something going wrong, I still struggle with how to get this. And I've seen groups that get along fine produce boring work. I've seen groups that are just at each other's throat produce great work. So the mistake early on was not kind of becoming attuned to these internal dynamics, which frankly, they're often around things that they're more real world than out there in the world. These are interpersonal relationships. You get a lot of sexism inside of groups. You know, the guys are dominating, or it's the opposite. You know, the gals are dominating. You know, or it's so trying to think about, okay, these gender issues don't just happen out there in the world. They're happening right within your group.
So how do you stay on top of that? I mean, do you talk to the like, what have you done? So I have a very, I don't know if it's a good strategy or bad strategy, but my strategy for dealing with this is intermediate deliverables.
Yeah.
So if the groups, they have to hand something in at week 2, and then at week 5, and then week 10, and then week 12, and then at the end of the semester. And so if it's a disaster, it's very clear very soon. And nobody wants to get their hands slapped over and over and over. And that usually, that things seem to get better by the end.
Right. And I mean, I scaffold projects too. Oftentimes I'll have them start with an individual project and then go into group work. And sometimes I change the groups, I'll shuffle the deck, or sometimes they'll be in the same group for 2 projects. And when that happens and you see things going wrong, then you are trying to manage a situation where you get people to communicate better. You get people to do the things they say they're going to do. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. And this is unfortunately the way the real world is too.
Right.
Projects,
right.
You know, can work. You know, Ed, you probably know that Gone with the Wind was like an unmitigated production disaster behind the scenes for the whole thing, you know.
And The Wizard of Oz.
Is that right?
Yeah. There were like 4 directors. I mean, George Cukor shot like 20 minutes of it.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, so it's this is the nature of, I think, you know, complex media work. It's not, again, it's not the original romantic genius doing all this, or you know
right,
it's a collaborative teamwork, and that's interpersonal social relationships.
And it's, and when you've got faculty that are used to working as individuals and have no training in collaboration themselves, trying to manage collaborative projects, it's not surprising that it's a suboptimal experience for a lot of students.
Right, and this is where I actually see, think theater, I mean, you think about in philosophy, Hegel and Kant, your primary modern aestheticians, and they prioritize the painter and the poet, who are these single creators. If they had prioritized theater, it would already be collaborative, it would already be multimediated, and it would already be recombinant, because theater is always mixing things up.
But yeah, that's really
so it's just and there was reasons they chose the poet and the painter. You know, film is a similar kind of, you know, that those are like tutor arts, because they are collaborative from the get-go.
Right. Even Woody Allen's not working by himself.
That's right, yeah.
All right. Well, this has been awesome.
Well, thank you
for joining us.
Yeah.
Go out there and keep creating.
All right, thanks.
That's everybody.
All
thanks
right.
for being here.
Thank you.
And that's all for this episode of the Teach Better podcast. If you want more, you can visit our website at teachbetter.co. You'll find links for the things we've talked about today in the show notes, as well as our old episodes. You can leave feedback for us on the site or email us at feedback@teachbetter.co. And you can always find us on Twitter @teachbetterco.